Welcome to Detectives by the Decade. This is the podcast that looks at the detectives, the scientists, and the cases that gave us forensics as we know it today. I'm Christy Baxter. A quick note before we begin. I'm choosing to finish off Season 2 with this final Pinkerton episode. Season 2 has been a little bit shorter than our first season, and I'll let you peek behind the curtain and show you why. When I first started Detectives by the Decade, I had every intention of it being a weekly podcast. And I really should have had more episodes ready to go before I started releasing them. But I got excited and my eyes got bigger than my stomach, as they say. Then life happened and things popped up demanding my attention, and it got harder and harder to keep up the weekly pace. When I moved to every other week as a release schedule, it was actually a really hard decision to make. So, I'm finishing Season 2 here, and I'm going to take some time, like I should have in the beginning, to do this right so that we can go back to weekly episodes. That means having several episodes ready to go when we start back up again, so Detectives by the Decade will likely be back late spring, and again, with weekly episodes, like most other podcasts. So stay tuned to the end of the episode for a few hints about what fun we're going to have on a weekly basis in Season 3. So, that's a bad news then good news kind of situation, which really mirrors, in reverse, some of the themes of the Pinkerton series. So with that, this is episode 25, The Detective and the Working Man. In 1892, the Carnegie Steel Company made a record $4.5 million in profits. Today, that would be about $132 million. Andrew Carnegie, the tycoon behind the behemoth company, was reported to have responded to this news with an enthusiastic cry of,
"Was there ever such a business?"
But one thing stood in the way of Carnegie making even more money. The Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers. The union had managed, through bargaining, to get a good contract for the workers, including the highest mill wages in the country. But prices were depressed from where they'd been a few years ago, and that had the big guys at the top looking for places to cut costs. With that contract coming up for negotiation, the management of Carnegie Steel saw an opening. The company tried to slash pay, the second such cut in 3 years. Many viewed this move as an attempt to provoke the workers into striking. And if that was the case, management got what it wanted, and so much more. At the Homestead Mill in Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, 3,800 men were locked out, and 2 days later, they went on the defense by storming the mill and closing the town off so strikebreakers and scabs couldn't interfere. Things got tense, and Carnegie's general manager, Henry Frick, brought in a private security force. 300 operatives from the Pinkerton Detective Agency who arrived via barge on July 6, 1892. At this time, the Pinkerton Detective Agency's supply of muscle was shocking, more active and reserve agents than there were soldiers in the U.S. Army. And the thousands of striking workers, along with family and friends who stood behind them, came to greet the Pinkerton agents. They weren't about to allow the Pinkertons to protect the scabs Frick wanted to bring in. And the Pinkertons' reputation had certainly preceded them. As one striker said,
"Our people, as a general thing, think they are a horde of cutthroats, thieves, and murderers, and are in the employ of unscrupulous capital for the oppression of honest labor."
This was not the first time the Pinkertons had been called in for a labor dispute. They'd been breaking up strikes using both subterfuge and violence for decades, which was why they got such an unwelcome reception. When they tried to land, despite warnings from the picketers, a 12-hour battle commenced. PBS's American Experience has a dramatic description of what happened as the two sides met, one obviously outmatched in weaponry and desperately improvising.
Outgunned by the Pinkertons' Winchester rifles, homestead citizens scoured the town for weapons, pressing into service everything from ancient muzzleloaders to a 20-pound cannon. Strikers rolled a flaming freight train car at the barges. They tossed dynamite to sink the boats and pumped oil into the river and tried to set it on fire.
And it really wasn't going well for the Pinkertons. One related that,
"The noise that they made on shore was awful, and it made it shake in our boots. We were penned in like rats, and we went at the fighting like desperate wild men. All of our men were under the beds and bunks, crying and trembling."
The Pinkertons, many of them wounded, couldn't even get a drink of water from their barge. And their white flag was literally shot down each time they tried to raise it. Until finally, with almost a dozen dead and many, many wounded, their fifth attempt at surrender was accepted, with an agreement that the Pinkertons would be let out of town and charged with murder. But it wasn't all peace and friendship just like that. Despite an assurance of safe passage through town, the crowd threw stones at them, beat them, and clubbed them. They made it out of Homestead and into Pittsburgh, where they were very much not charged with murder. There's potentially an even more sinister aspect to all of this. Now, I'd like this next bit of discussion to be accompanied by a mostly full shaker of salt. This particular aspect doesn't seem to have made it into any modern accounts of the Homestead Strike that I've read, nor does it make it into Pinkerton's own accounts, although that's hardly surprising. In a July 1892 issue of the Boston Globe, of which almost the entirety of page 4 is dedicated to news of the strike, a reporter interviews one of the supposed Pinkerton agents who'd been on the barge. They said they'd actually been lured by advertisements in Chicago seeking watchmen, and that they were among about 100 men who'd been so deceived. After being locked up on a train to Pennsylvania, then put on a boat under armed guard, then arriving at Homestead, the men were finally told their purpose.
"Each man was given a Winchester and told to use it. We were then told we were brought here to guard property and must do it at any risk. Many of us refused to do it and said we would leave the boat. Then some fellow stepped out and said he would shoot the first man who left the boat."
The man went on to say that he didn't shoot once the entire time. Now, this is a likely story. It's a story that an agent would likely come up with to try to weasel out of any charges related to the battle at Homestead. But It also could be the story of a man who was tricked into joining an armed force breaking a strike because a detective agency didn't want to send their actual agents. Pinkerton refused to talk about anything related to the Homestead incident, except when asked if they'd tricked men into joining the fray. He emphatically denied that, stating that they had bushels of applications men had left at his office that he could easily have drawn upon if he needed more men. Newspapers reported that if further men were to go to Homestead to act against the strikers, they would do so quietly, as the locals had been left with quite negative feelings against the Pinkertons. Not just the working men, but the entire general populace. And those feelings had been prevalent enough before the conflict. There's a lot more that happened afterward, but that's the involvement of the Pinkerton Detective Agency in the Battle of Homestead. In the end, after the militia and strikebreakers were brought in, after an assassination attempt on Frick, after press and public opinion turned against the strikers, the Union bowed to Carnegie's terms. And that was pretty much the end of the strike and the Union. This is but one of many clashes between the Pinkertons and labor organizers. The workers' reaction itself, to try to bar the Pinkertons from even entering the town by any means necessary, seeing the Pinkerton arrival as akin to a declaration of war, speaks to their reputation. It's easy to imagine, without any further context, that the strikers got heated and mob rule, well, ruled. And in that way, to place all the blame on the working men. But the tentacles of history, of reputation, burrow deep in our minds. And with all the past incidents the Pinkertons had famously been involved in, well, we can't excuse the violence of the strikers, no. But we can understand why the arrival of the Pinkertons caused such profound distress among the steelworkers of Homestead. The Pinkerton Detective Agency's history of being involved in violent actions against unionization goes back two decades before the Homestead strike. The company's major union-busting activities seem to start around the 1870s. And at first, they favored subterfuge over direct violence. A Pinkerton agent infiltrated a labor-minded secret society called the Molly Maguires, and his actions eventually ended in the disbanding of the group. Now, this sounds like the Pinkertons got out of this one with clean hands, but not entirely. The Pinkerton agent ensured that some of the information he'd gathered made it into the hands of vigilantes, who then tracked down those they believed to be members, killed them, and killed their families. Not a good look, Pinky. It's been four episodes now. I think I can give him a condescending nickname, right? One only needs to read Pinky's own description of the men and women involved in the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 to know that, much as he may have tried to pose as a friend to the workers, he was anything but. For example, this was his description of bargaining movements after a 10% reduction of wages for anyone making more than a dollar a day, or around $25 in today's money.
Utterly worthless employees began their secret meetings and their seditious efforts. It is an established fact that the great body of employees accepted the reduction with good grace. In fact, more than 3/4 of the employees of the road, and immeasurably the most deserving, capable, and valuable class of its employees, had received the reduction in an appreciative and manly way.
Look, I'm just speculating here, but I'm guessing that this is some heavy spin bordering on outright lies on his part. Charitably, we could just say he lacks the self-awareness to understand his own part in some men's refusal to join their fellow workers. To understand how fear of strike-breaking thugs, of violence, of losing their income, might influence those who passed on union-related activities. I doubt that more than a few people, if any, took a 10% wage reduction with a shrug and a, what are you gonna do? And it's not like it was the lowest of the lower classes, the most unskilled workers who were involved in these efforts. Not that that would matter, but it's important for context to understand just how many employees this affected, and the influence some of them might have had. Remember, the reduction hit those with incomes over $1 a day, who were doing work that was inherently dangerous. In 1877, that was nearly everyone on the railroad. Nationwide, the average daily wages for a conductor were $3.57. For engineers, $3.76. For firemen, $1.87. That meant that just about every employee took a 10% pay cut. One does have to wonder if that reduction made its way to the front office employees, the big bosses, or anyone in positions of power. Pinkerton has a few more fusillades to launch in his propagandist literary strike against the strikers.
Men with hate in their desperate faces gathered in groups and in low tones plotted and threatened. The slums and alleys turned out their miserable inhabitants with faces of brutes, women with faces of demons.
He's literally demonizing them. Demon! He says it, right there. And it's not the only time. The previous example, and those following, are from his book, Strikers, Communists, Tramps, and Detectives. From a description of a coal strike in 1869.
They kill and plunder and butcher like demons, destroy the very interests which place bread into their mouths, and then, because they have recklessly crippled their employers, strike and kill and burn again. What should be the fairest garden spot of the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is swiftly becoming such a pest hole of anarchy and murder that it would almost seem the time is not far distant when it will become necessary to chase these demons, like foxes, from the fair mountains with fire and sword.
There. Pinkerton is not only, again, literally demonizing strikes and labor organizers, and twice in one section being annoyingly repetitive as he slams the hammer of his self-righteousness over our heads again and again, but he's even going so far as to justify violence against them. This is part of what makes Pinkerton such a hard man to square. He was an ardent abolitionist, even going so far as to make his shop a stop on the Underground Railroad. So, it seemed he was of the opinion that men should be compensated for their work. But it also seemed, with his opinions on strikes and strikers, that there was a difference between compensation and fair compensation, and working men shouldn't be the ones to determine what fair compensation meant, nor should they decide what safety or rational working hours meant. On the one hand, we can wonder if maybe his personal beliefs didn't quite line up with the direction he took the agency. If he sacrificed his values a bit in the name of making money and a name for himself. But I don't think that's the case at all. He certainly defends his stance against unionization in the quotes that came earlier. No, I think the winds of change started blowing as industrialization proliferated, and Pinkerton picked his side, likely without too many sleepless nights. And his men became the force to call when big cat capitalists needed to break a strike. Did other union-busting detective agencies pop up in the Pinkerton wake? Of course! But for the past century and a half, if you think strikebreakers, you think Pinkerton. And while there was a time when that wasn't the case, good old Pinky made sure that his company became synonymous with anti-union sentiment. As Sarah Jones says in The New Republic, bosses once hired the firm because its agents would do just about anything to break a strike. Pinkerton agents would lie and kill if necessary. They could do things and go places law enforcement could not. End quote. And this tended to end badly for many involved, but especially for the unions. The following conflicts are far, far more complicated than I'm about to portray them here, and I'm likely doing them a grave disservice. But if we got into the weeds on each of them, we'd be here all week, and even though you'd be forgiven for thinking so, this is not the Labor Organizers and Strikebreakers podcast. In 1892, silver miners in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, were fighting for all workers, laborers and skilled, to be paid $3.50 a day. That's about $104 in today's money. They went on strike on this principle. Soon enough, not only Pinkertons, but also agents of the Teal Detective Agency were showing up in town. When everything finally escalated to gun battles, the casualties were even on both sides, 3-3. The town ended up under martial law for 4 months, with union members being identified by a Pinkerton agent who'd infiltrated the organization, then rounded up and kept without charges, until the courts finally ruled that unlawful. Obviously. And it was in the 1890s that laws began popping up against the Pinkertons. Circling back to the first episode of the Pinkerton series, Congress passed a law in 1893 to keep the government from hiring private guards. Finally, also due to the Battle of Homestead, 26 states banned the use of Pinkertons or other private detective agencies in strike breaking. Now, timing-wise, the majority of these points of interest happened after Pinkerton's death in 1884. His two sons were running the show for a lot of this. It might be easy to try to fob responsibility for the bloodshed and anti-worker activity on them, if not for the fact that we have Pinkerton's own words, again, literally demonizing workers. Not to mention that the agency's union busting activities did start under Pinky's watchful eye. By some accounts, despite his constant slamming of the unions, he actually had a sort of paternalistic feeling towards the working man, and felt that they should be afforded some rights. He just didn't necessarily agree with them on what those rights should be, or how they should go about obtaining them. But those weren't his decisions to make, or they shouldn't have been. And while today the company has ostensibly veered away from getting involved in labor disputes, it can't seem to help itself when it comes to a big, juicy contract. Like, say, maybe with Amazon? The behemoth company reportedly hired the Pinkertons to monitor social media of union organizers and warehouse workers in Poland. There may even be operatives on the ground, infiltrating warehouses. Just like the old days. And this is very likely to be happening in America, too. Some things never change, I guess. Amazon, of course, denies this. So, we started this little mini-series with the question, what is the legacy of the Pinkertons and of Alan Pinkerton himself? Well, that's really for you to decide. But if you want my opinion, I think he did some good stuff. He did some bad stuff. Like many human beings, most, in fact, he probably thought he was right whether his actions and the actions of those he directed were for the good or the bad. If human history proves anything, it's that just because you think you're right doesn't mean you are. And the man, when you come right down to it, had some authoritarian tendencies. And hey, some of you may be more on the side of the industrialist than the working man. You may have more of an authoritarian bent than I do, which is not hard. And you're perfectly allowed to pick sides. So what you think of Pinkerton may be more influenced by your own personal leanings than a single word I've said in these 4 episodes. When it comes right down to it, yeah. Pinkerton was a human being. We're all flawed, complex creatures. As far as the more narrow focus of this podcast is concerned, I'll break it down to the basics. Pinkerton founded the first detective agency in the United States, hired the first female detective, used that detective agency and that female detective to do some really good stuff in the Civil War, and then veered in an entirely different direction that would have dire consequences for the working people and their families. And that, when it comes right down to it, is the legacy. It's all the good stuff, then what I consider the not-so-good stuff, and it's like following a dinner of some of your favorite foods with a quick shot of castor oil. You might have enjoyed it at first, but then it got pretty unpleasant, and what happened after that was so burned in your memory that it taints the whole meal. So, the tagline for this little mini-series, I guess, could be Pinkerton. Like getting food poisoning from a Michelin-starred restaurant. Fun at first, then less fun, and if you're me, you're just really glad when it's finally over. on that note, that's it for this episode. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe. Hey, stay subscribed, even though we're going on hiatus. That way, you'll know when we come back. I don't know why I talk like there's more than one of me, but okay. Come on over to Old Timey Crimey, where we're having a really great time talking about historical true crime. Or listen to me briefly talk short stories with my buddy Chris Garcia over on Short Story Short Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram and Facebook as Detectives by the Decade or on Twitter as By the Decade. And I'll be posting some updates as we go along and maybe even a couple of quick peeks behind the scenes. It's not all that exciting. It's a lot of flipping back and forth between a browser window and a Word document. But maybe I'll find something exciting. Also, you should come tell me what you think of Pinkerton, good old Pinky, now that all is said and done. This episode's town shout-out goes to Dallas, Texas. Hey, Dallas. Looks like you got a few Detectives by the Decade heads down there? Something? I don't know. But hi to all of you. As promised, here are some of the highlights of what we'll be hitting next season. Blood! And how we learned to determine whether it's present and whether it's human. Crime scene photography! Oh boy, is the social media gonna be fun for that. Some super fun junk science we can all look down on and feel better about ourselves. Ballistics! Shooting the guns and then finding out who shot what out of the guns. It's very exciting. So it's going to be a fantastic time, and I can't wait. And I hope you will all join me when we start back up again. And it's weekly, so these decades might actually start passing a little bit more quickly. Detectives by the Decade is researched, written, and produced by me, Christy Baxter. Voice acting by the distinguished Scott Mort. Music by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for listening. I'll see you soon. My sources this week are Alan Pinkerton, Strikers, Communists, Tramps, and Detectives. Oh, you. Sarah Jones in the New Republic, The Boston Globe via newspapers.com. Thank you, Chris Garcia. PBS, The American Experience, and Ari Shapiro and Lauren Corey Gurley on All Things Considered on NPR. Transmission music. I don't know why I'm talking so nasal, but I should finish the podcast like this.